My name is Tom Spencer, and I'm the secondary principal at Logos School. I've been at the school for 11 years. Started out teaching full-time, and then 5 years ago took over administration of the junior high and the high school. Before I begin, the outline is on page 14 in your notebook, and I made a mistake under part 2, the stages of childhood. If you'd correct those for me before we begin. A says poly, and it should be poll parrot. And B says poll parrot, and it should read pert. Yep, under the stages of childhood, where it says poly, it should say poll parrot. And on B, where it says poll parrot, it should read pert. My mistake. Well, I want to talk about the use of the trivium, definition and its application, and really relying most heavily on Dorothy Sayers' model as she visualized this and put this together. The trivium literally means the threefold way, and we could spend our time looking at the historical uses of the trivium. The Greeks talked about a trivium, and they had three subjects that were included. And the Romans talked about a trivium, and they had three different stages that were included. There was a trivium used during the Middle Ages, and it's something that's been a part of education for a long, long time. And we could look at the components of the trivium and how they changed historically, but we really don't need to make the application that we're interested in today. But it means the threefold way. What it is, it's a model for method and organization. As described in Dorothy Sayers' article, The Lost Tools of Learning, it really is a model, or it provides us a structure for our K-12 education system. It gives us some organization, and it addresses more method than content. And I wanted to start, that's one of the two points I wanted to start with, because I often see, maybe not confusion, but different interpretations. If I brought my secondary staff in and we talked about how much content is required in order to apply the trivium, we would start a pretty good debate. There's some difference of opinion among us. But my understanding of the application is content is really grist for the mill, as Dorothy Sayers says. It's secondary to the purposes. You need it to fulfill the needs, to meet the goals of the trivium. But if you're going to teach the trivium, you want to be sure that you don't confuse providing a classical education with being a classicist. I think those are two different things. Certainly there may be some value in reading Homer, in studying Greek, Roman literature, and I'm not to say there isn't. The point I want to make at the beginning is in order to teach according to the classical model, that's not required. It's not prescriptive of content. It focuses most on method, and it's useful for organization. The other point that you need to keep in mind right from the beginning is that the focus of the trivium has always been, regardless of what age we're talking about, it has always been focused on preparation for further study in what was called the quadrivium. The trivium was never an end in itself, but it always focused on working with students to prepare them for another stage or another step in their own education. And that's one of the key things you need to keep in mind when you start to think about the trivium. If you can see the chalkboard, the purpose of the trivium, the focus was in preparation for the quadrivium. The quadrivium consisted of different subjects that students were being prepared to handle in the trivium. The trivium was supposed to give the students the tools that they needed, the abilities and the skills that they needed to go and tackle the subjects of the quadrivium. That was its purpose. And again, the subjects change throughout history, but it really doesn't matter what the subjects are. If you understand that the students went through the trivium, they were being prepared. And those who were teaching them were aware that they were being prepared for something that would follow. In teaching the trivium, you have to have something to use these tools upon. So different subjects have been used. And you can use subjects today that are common in schools: English, science, history, math. We use those subjects to teach the tools of the trivium. But what we've done in education is we've erased the quadrivium from the picture. And what we've taken away when we've done that is we've taken away a focus of the trivium of preparation for further study, and what we're left with is these subjects themselves. So one mistake that's being made in education today is when we approach history, just as the subject of history. We think about it, when a student graduates from high school, our goal is to teach them all the history that they'll ever learn, because they won't go on their own and study it. And so we have to think about, what are all the important things that we have to teach them? Instead of thinking of it, in using history, how can we give them tools of learning and use history to do that as our content in order to prepare them for further study? So there's been a real shift in the philosophy of our education and the goals of our education from talking about, in today's vernacular, K-12 education as preparation for further study, to the modern idea where K-12 education, the subjects become an end in themselves. And that's a key understanding that especially teachers in the classroom have to develop. It's so critical that the teachers understand how is what I'm doing in my classroom fitting in with this broader picture, this bigger picture of preparing these kids for what comes next. Well, I want to talk about the three parts of the trivium that Dorothy Sayers described in her essay. The first is grammar. When we talk about grammar, most of us think of the grammar of some language. And it includes that, but the definition of grammar that Dorothy Sayers uses is broader in its application. Grammar is defined as the fundamental rules of each subject. Every subject in a school has its own basic grammar. If we're talking about history, we're talking about names of important people, key historical events, key places. We talk about math or certain mathematical facts of addition, multiplication, so on, that students have to learn that form the grammar of math. We talk about science. If we're talking about younger kids, we might talk about maybe classification or some different specific elements in science. But each subject has its own grammar. Bible has its grammar. Major characters in the Old Testament, major characters in the New Testament. Identification of certain characteristics or qualities of God that children can understand. But that's the first stage of the trivium, is the fundamental rules of each subject, not just English. The second part of the trivium is referred to as dialectic or logic. And once a student has understood what the individual parts of a subject are, the dialectic or logic starts to put them together in ordered relationships. So dialectic is the ordered relationship of that subject's particulars. And in this stage, we're trying to teach the students how to think. We want them to be able, for example, to define terms and understand the importance of that. We want students to be able to make accurate statements. We want students to be able to construct arguments. And we want students to be able to detect fallacies, not only in their own work, but in things they read or hear from other people. These are things associated with the dialectic stage. to back up and say the Dorothy Sayers prescribed sort of a key subject to revolve each stage around, and in grammar, the key subject is the study of Latin. And in the dialectic stage, the key, the focus is on logic and disputation, the study of formal logic and means and methods of arguments and preparing good arguments. The third stage of the trivium is rhetoric. Rhetoric is the ability to clearly and eloquently express yourself, whether it's an oral form or written form. It's the clear and concise expression of ideas. And so you really see in the first two stages of the trivium, especially if we're talking about grammar, if we're talking about logic, we're not so much talking about subjects. We're not talking about individual subjects that form part of the trivium. We're talking about things that we want to develop in kids with the idea that this is going to prepare them for their study of the quadrivium or the study that they're going to undertake once we finish the trivium. Well, in her essay, Dorothy Sayers then goes on to talk about children. And when we look at, she identifies three different stages in children that those who are teaching the trivium would be concerned with. But one thing that you need to remember when you start to look at these stages of childhood is remember the basis for Dorothy Sayers' classification. She wasn't a child psychologist. She said so in her essay. She says the child that she knew best was herself. And so when she identified these three stages, she thought about herself and how she changed as she grew and what her qualities and characters were. And the reason that I mention this is, while I think the parts of the trivium can be somewhat clearly identified, the parts of the stages of childhood are a little bit less clear. It's more difficult to draw fine lines between one stage and another. And she mentions that too. She talks about the overlap of these stages of childhood. But that's something, if you go to look to apply the trivium, you have to make some decisions about, well, what age are we going to do this? When are children able to do that? And you may come up with some different answers. And part of the reason is because of the nature of children that grow and develop at different rates. And part of it, if you remember this description that we're working from, is based on Dorothy Sayers herself. So you may find the need to make some changes between them. And if you start talking about this in a group, you may find people have some differences. And that's okay. It's understandable. But the first stage is the stage of elementary children, the poll parrot stage. And she thought back and she thought, what were the characteristics and qualities? And I think she must have been outstanding, had a wonderful memory, but also probably her ability to observe and pick out these characteristics is really impressive about children, because I think she really picked out some key qualities and characteristics. So for young children in this poll parrot stage, first of all, learning by heart is easy. It's something that comes natural to them. And if you want to find out if this is true, sit down with one of these younger children and play the memory or concentration card game. Okay? I've heard adults say, and I've heard my own kids say, or wonder if you're letting them win. And they don't realize you're not. But it's really amazing to watch that process, to see how easy it is for young children to memorize things. Not only is learning by heart easy, they enjoy it. That's another characteristic of this stage. It's pleasurable to them. They enjoy doing it. Much different than if people who have passed this stage, or adults, say, for example, try and commit things like learning a new foreign language. It becomes work. And we may still know satisfaction once we've accomplished it, but the act itself doesn't have the same joy that it does for a young child. On the other hand, for children in this poll parrot stage, reasoning is difficult. It's hard for them to think in abstract terms, and they don't enjoy being asked to do that. Black and white is good. Things that are shades of gray are not so fun. Just tell me the bottom line, tell me the answer. Don't make it too difficult. Well, that's the first stage of elementary children. The next stage is the pert stage. You'd know when you read her description, she not only knew herself, she must have been around some children who were in this stage, because it's so accurate. She talks about their contradicting behavior, or their enjoyment of answering back, the way they like to catch people out, as she puts it, especially their elders, parents or teachers who've made some kind of mistake, and their delight that comes with being able to point that out. When we started to teach logic to eighth graders a few years ago, our logic teacher heard back from some parents who said, "I'm not sure if I like you teaching my children formal logic," because it was being applied in the home. Respectfully, of course, I trust. And the other characteristics he talks about, children in the pert stage have a high nuisance value. Okay? But it's a different stage of childhood. And finally, she describes the poetic stage. It's a difficult age, she says. Children in the poetic stage are self-centered. Sounds like early teenagers to me. Children yearn to express themselves. They're restless. And this is something that hasn't changed. They have a strong desire to achieve independence. We see that a lot of ways in kids who are in the early teen years. Their desire to be independent. And one of the keys here, real keys for how we apply the trivium, is that children in the poetic age begin to show signs of creativity or original thinking. They also are reaching out, she says, towards synthesis. They've had classes taught in different subjects, and they want to break down some of those barriers that seem to have been presented to them and try to fit things together. That's another key quality of the poetic stage. Well, in her essay, I think so creative, what Dorothy Sayers did was she looked back to the trivium, to the grammar and the logic and the rhetoric, and she matched it with these stages of childhood. And she said these things fit together well. During the grammar stage, we can take advantage of the natural abilities of children to give them one of the building blocks, one of the tools of learning that they need. So she took the three stages of the trivium and the three stages of childhood, and she said, let's put them together. And this can be how we organize what we are interested in K-12 education. So it's really a framework for organizing what we teach. But remember again, everything that's being taught, as we start to talk about application, we should be able to ask ourselves, how is this preparing kids for what will come later? So we go back to this first stage, the grammar stage, the fundamental rules of each subject. Kids have a natural ability to like to memorize things. So I heard Doug Wilson use an analogy once. He said, children in this stage are like empty hard drives with lots of empty memory. So our job during this time is to fill that memory up. Fill up those hard drives with things that they enjoy learning now, and it will be important to them that they have committed to memory later. For example, if you think about children, this is the time in their life when they need to learn multiplication tables. So much easier. Those kids who learn them now and have them committed to memory have such an advantage over the kids who don't quite get that done and have to struggle harder trying to commit those things to memory later. So what we need to do is we need to identify, we need to think about the different subjects that we teach, because we have to have something to practice the tools of learning on. So we need to think about, well, what subjects do we think are important, and what are the pieces or the parts of that subject that we think it's important that people just know, they have committed to long-term memory. Multiplication tables are one of those things. If we started to talk about math, that's one of the things that we'd identify is say, this is something that children need to know. So now, when they're able to memorize, is the time to teach them. But we can do this with more subjects than math. In fact, we can do it with every subject. There are certain things we want them to know in English about the parts of speech. In one of the workshops, Mrs. Jordan is going to talk about the Shirley Method. And one of the reasons it's so successful is it identifies the key components of English grammar and has this idea of let's take advantage of teaching them to children while they're at this age when they learn things readily. And it uses chants and songs. And it's so successful for some of those reasons. So if you want to get more, another idea of how this specifically could be applied, that'd be a good workshop to take advantage of. We saw this year at Logos our third grade teacher be responsible for teaching U.S. history. One of the things he wants children to learn is the states of the United States. And he did a wonderful job taking this vision of this philosophy and putting it into practice. The kids did a lot of oral recitation and did a lot of singing and learned some of these key facts about different states that they would put to music and that they would put to chants and that they would practice. A lot of repetition. And these kids are going to have some of these key things about U.S. history committed to long-term memory as a result. We see this applied sometime in Bible. And one of the things about Bible brings up is it necessary for the children to understand everything that they're being asked to memorize? And the answer is no. It's okay if there are some things that they don't understand now, because they will later. We do this as parents sometimes when we have our children memorize scripture, and they may not understand all the concepts. There's a wonderful tape series called Hide Them in Your Heart Songs. It's just verses, God's truth put to song, you know, because we want our kids to have that committed to memory now. They don't understand it now, but that's okay, because there will come a time as the children grow that we'll go back and we'll talk about the things that the kids have memorized, and they'll gain the understanding at a later time. But if we wait, it's more difficult for them to memorize those things. Now we want to think about, okay, how can we prepare children for the grammar in the grammar stage for what comes later? Well, later on in the trivium, we want them to be able to express themselves well orally. Well, let's practice some oral recitation. Let's have them recite things out loud in class. Something I think that was more popular at an earlier time in our nation's history and the way we taught in schools than it has been recently. But something children enjoy doing still, nevertheless. So we start to look at these subjects, and someone might say, well, this is classical education, but those subjects don't look very different. And you're right, they don't. The subjects, you couldn't look at the subjects. If you're just looking at what courses or what subjects are taught, even you might not be able to tell that that's a classical model that's being used, because it has to come from the attitude or the approach that the teachers have towards what the children are learning. That they keep in the back of their mind, these aren't subjects in themselves, but this is preparation for something comes later. Well, the first question comes up. The first stage is pull parrot. The second stage is pert. When do we make the transition? Where do we draw the line? One of the key things, I think, that one of the clues in the Dorothy Sayers article is she mentioned someone refers to her as one of the key qualities is the children gain a capacity for abstract thought. Young children like things that are concrete. And it's not until they develop and their brain develops that they begin to develop an ability to think abstractly. One of the applications that is easiest for me to conceptualize is this is when we begin to teach children algebra. We replace concrete numbers that they can see with symbols for numbers in equations. That requires abstract thought. Okay. If we teach that too early, children will become frustrated because they don't have the ability to think that way. So one of the keys when we move from one stage to another is, are the children beginning to develop the ability for abstract thought? And when they are, then we move more into the PERT stage. Okay, well, children like to argue at this stage. They like to debate. They like to question why. So let's give them formal tools. Let's teach them formal logic. Let's teach them how to construct good arguments. If they want to express themselves, let's give them the means to do so in a way that will be helpful in persuading others later that they're correct. So let's teach them about premises. Let's teach them about defining terms that they're using in their own arguments or when they're writing in papers. Again, the subjects become grist for the mill. We take history. We want to analyze people in history, maybe according to what God says about people. We want to apply principles. Was this right? Was this wrong? How do we know? By what standard? We want to use history to start to apply rules of formal logic to, and let them debate those things. And that becomes one of the real keys that we can use when we're educating children at this age. Logic lends itself into debate. One of the things that seems in our practice to take longer is the ability to identify fallacies in others. That's definitely a goal that we have. We want to be able to read things, and we focus more on criticism at this time than appreciation. But we want them to examine the logical arguments in what they're reading or on what they're hearing. And that takes practice, and that takes time. But we want to start to teach the children to think this way. Not to accept everything that they read. If it's in a textbook, it must be true. But to question assumptions and to challenge things. When do we go from the next stage? When do we go from the PERT to the poetic? One of the key qualities there from when we change is imagination. The children being able to think creatively and to have some original ideas that they come up with. Not just summarizing things that they've been given, but actually creating new things, putting together connections in their own mind. Now, the subjects that we've been following through the trivium that would look common in our schools, the English, science, history, math, etc., those become less important now. Because one of the things that we hope children have learned by this point is, where has God gifted them, in what areas, and what do they enjoy doing? We require kids to study all these different subjects up to this point. Hopefully, by this time, they're starting to gain a sense of what it is they'd like to do, what it is that they're good at. And so we should provide some flexibility, some means now for them not to specialize, but to be able to have more time to focus on those areas that they decide they want to pursue. So they may have some freedom as far as selecting subjects, but now what we want to work on is, you've thought of these ideas, how do we organize them? Using the formal logic, and how do we persuade? What tools do we bring to make your arguments persuasive? What means can you use to make yourself an eloquent speaker? How do you present different things in the most effective way to communicate the ideas that you have, using some of the interests that they have naturally? Ages on these things are, I think, are hard, as I mentioned earlier, to decide, because there's some overlap. Children move through ages differently. The other thing that's really changed when we look at Dorothy Sayre's article is, when are students ready for the quadrivium? We may have some students that are ready more by the time they finished their junior year in high school. We may have some students that probably could use another year. We're probably a little bit too structured still in our scheduling and in what we think is required for K-12 education in thinking that one through. But again, the poetic stage is giving them a tool that they'll go use now, and a little bit of guided practice in starting to do what they're going to do more fully in the quadrivium. one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is something else, and that's how we can use different types of writing assignments to match up with these three stages. You know, a lot of times we ask kids to answer study questions. Well, where does that have value? It doesn't cause students, if you ask them to identify the answers to study questions, that doesn't have a lot of value in getting them to come up with their own original ideas. They go back to the text and they'll look for the text to pick out the specific things that we ask them to identify, not thinking real creatively, and they won't think much about the process of writing when they do that. They'll think solely on the product. Well, which stage does that have the most application? Well, probably in the first, in the grammar stage. Helping them to identify what those key ideas or key concepts are that we want them to know. Why would we ask a student in the dialectic or the logic stage to answer study questions? Well, there may be certain things that come up. There's still going to be some grammar of subjects in that stage. What are the key terms here? How are they defined? How does this author develop his argument? What's his premise? What's his conclusion? How does he get from one to another? So that might be a more appropriate task to ask students in the dialectic or the logic stage to complete. They're going to think about the product, the what of what they're writing, but that will also help them to think about the process of writing. What about during the rhetoric stage? Well, I think we ask students in the rhetoric stage sometimes to do study questions. And it's probably no surprise that they don't get real excited about that. That doesn't create a lot of interest in the subject, and if it's overused, it can become very tedious. Well, what do we ask students in the poetic stage to do? Well, how about analytic essays? How about seeing now if they can organize their own thoughts in response to some reading that they've done? How about their own ability to put connections together? And it's the role of the teacher, I think, at this point to start to frame the right questions that'll motivate the students. They've read some things between different authors, so we start to ask them about cause and effect, relationships between different ideas. We give them an opportunity to see connections and learn from the writing that they're doing things that they haven't been taught or heard before, but it's original expression. And hopefully they bring to bear the tools that they brought with them from the first two stages to do that. Well, in the reverse, if you ask a student in the grammar stage to come up with some original thesis, that'll be pretty difficult. That takes abstract thought, and they may become frustrated with that. So we want to give them more structured writing assignments to do. And I think as teachers, we need to think more about when we assign writing to students, what type of learning do we want to result from the writing that we're asking them to do, rather than just, I've got this time to fill, and so here, I'll give you some writing to do. Now, writing's wonderful. John Milton Gregory said, one of the real truths of education is that the work of education is much more the work of the student than the teacher. One of the positive aspects of writing is each of the students is working independently and having to deal with the content and think through it themselves. But I think that writing we need to think about. Well, let me just repeat a couple things in closing that I think it's important to remember. Remember that I think what we've done today is we've taken away the quadrivium. We've taken away this forward orientation, this future orientation to what we're teaching students today, and we need to bring that back. We need to look ahead as teachers. We need to think about preparation. And we're not necessarily preparing students solely for college. We're preparing them how to learn and teaching them how to think. They may go into a vocation and we want them to be the best educated person in that vocation that we know. We want them to know, how do I tackle this new information that I'm now required to have at my fingertips? How do I go about learning a new subject? We didn't have this one in school. The students shouldn't be intimidated by that. but thinking about further study is really important, and then making sure that what we're teaching to students matches up with their natural abilities, interests, and attitudes. Yes. Well, you certainly do it. You do it in Bible in elementary stages, and you help by identifying, as the parents have done, this is what's right, this is what's wrong, according to God's standard. But you wait then until a later stage to ask the kids to draw that own conclusion for themselves. But you teach them the same process that their parent went through. If you come up with some situation later on, and they need to decide what's moral, then hopefully you'll teach them what their parents did, what's the standard, and how to go about answering that question. But you match what you tell them with their age and ability.
Can you start out with, say, ethics, and then go on to fix morality, and do
integral
ethics?
Well, I'm not sure you start out with etiquette. I think you probably, there's some aspects of morality that you teach from the very beginning.
Well, yeah. Etiquette is kind of a grammar.
Right.
Quadrivium.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote down a short definition of process. Is that right? And these are past tense?
The quadrivium included different subjects. Math might be one. Astronomy might have been one in the past. They were more. There were usually four of them. They were configured. There were four different subjects that students would study, and depending on what time period, there would be some difference among those subjects. Theology would be a large one, because a lot of the quadrivium was then preparing people to teach the word or to minister. But they would be the actual different subjects that students would then pursue, usually at a college or a university. But they would come to that with some basic understanding, some basic factual knowledge, with a knowledge of formal logic, and with the ability to write well and to express themselves well. Okay?
What would be a parable today? Are we saying that?
Yeah, the question. This last question: what would be a parallel to the quadrivium?
Quadrivium is just further study, as we know, universities, colleges, trade schools.
Right. It could be any of those things. I think a parallel today would be a student during the poetic stage identifying their interest. They may decide upon a major that they want to pursue, or it doesn't. That would be the closest parallel, and they would be prepared then to tackle that new learning that they would be required to know. Okay. Yes.
Could I equate that to what becomes kind of a common term recently, and that's lifelong learning?
Yes. Yes, very much. Because we want what this process says is it's. Sometimes we have a fallacy of thinking the only place that you can learn is in a classroom in a school. And in order for you to be able to learn, there has to be somebody who knows the material who's going to share it with you. And you're not able to do it on your own. And this is the reverse. This is, you can learn on your own, not, I won't say completely apart from others, because certainly we use the ideas of those who've pioneered the ground before us, but you can be given the tools of learning so you know how to go about attacking a new subject. Okay. Thank you.